ahead and get started. We'll leave the door open a couple of minutes for people to trickle in. So I wanted to welcome you to colloquium today. We're going to have Anna Crom Lukens, as I pronounce it correctly, talk to us. But before that happens, Ruthie is going to introduce her. So if you'd like to come on out.
Well, we're letting Ruthie hobble up here in her broken foot.
Does anyone have any announcements that they would like to share?
Yeah, I'd like to announce. Hi. I'd like to announce that Marla Spivak from University of Minnesota will be visiting and giving a seminar this Thursday. It's called Bees Have Social Healthcare, and it'll be in 4140 Cali at 4 o'clock this Thursday.
Good. Anything else? Okay, Ruthie?
Hello, everyone. Originally from Virginia, Dr. Anna Crom Lukens received her bachelor's with distinction from the University of Virginia in History and Anthropology, where she then went on to receive her master's and PhD from UNC Chapel Hill University, where she currently resides as a teaching assistant professor in their Department of Public Policy in the College of Arts and Science. She directs UNC Chapel Hill's Public Policy Capstone program and also teaches first year courses on higher education and food policy. Her research focuses on the history of social welfare and public health policies, particularly the history of North Carolina's eugenics and social welfare programs in the early 20th century. Anna is currently working on a book manuscript entitled Reform and Regeneration, Eugenics and the Welfare State in the South, which demonstrates the lasting influence of eugenics in the shaping welfare policies and conceptions of citizenship, which she created, or the basis from this came from her senior undergraduate capstone project. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Anna Crom Lukens as she begins to show us this company that's supposed to pay the hundred for 10 years. Thank you.
I turn my UNC cap around. Thanks, Lucy. So you feel welcome.
Thanks. Yeah, I think that. No, I was actually going to thank you all for how well my bracket's doing. I have NC State going to the Final Four, and I'm convinced that's why I'm winning on my bracket right now. So
you're like the only one whose brackets aren't destroyed.
Yeah, my husband's losing, but I'm doing well thanks to y'all. Well, thank you so much for having me today. As Ruthie mentioned, I'm nearly done with the book. The book's written. I'm sort of in the final stages of review with UNC Press. But this is the first chance I've had in a while to talk about the project. I'm not going to tell you the whole book today. Don't worry. But thinking about it from a slightly bigger perspective, and I usually only talk to historians, so this will be a refreshing change, and I'm really looking forward to your feedback and your questions. There are the slides. I've subtitled my talk today, Science, Ideology, and Policy, but I'm going to talk mainly, of course, about eugenics in North Carolina. So I think I'm speaking to a crowd who knows what the basic concept of eugenics is, but just to give a couple high points about eugenics in the United States. The eugenics policies in the United States mostly happened at the state level. So sterilization programs, institutions being built, these happened at the state level with guidance from several national organizations. The first sterilization law was passed in Indiana in 1907, and many other states followed pretty rapidly after that. And then there were also other kinds of policies like marriage restrictions or attempts at immigration restrictions as well. So that's just to kind of situate it in the national context. North Carolina, though, is a really interesting state to look at and an important state to look at. We were the first state in the South both to open an institution for what were then called feeble-minded children and also to pass a statewide sterilization. Under that law, or its sister laws over time, over 7,600 people were sterilized over the course of four decades, which makes North Carolina's sterilization program boasts both one of the longest running programs in the country and one of the most active. We have the highest per capita sterilization rate of any state in the country. And perhaps because of that, more recently, North Carolina was also the first state to award some kind of financial compensation to victims of the sterilization program. So my book, and Ruthie read the title, and I've never liked the title, so please, if all we accomplished today is renaming my book, great, but this is a win. But it's called Reform and Regeneration, Eugenics in the Southern Welfare State. And I focus in that book really on the question of how did we get to the place where we sterilized all these people? The question that's always driven me is why, as a society, did we think that was a good and a reasonable solution to social problems? So I look at the first four-ish decades of the 20th century, 1900 to 1940, and I circle mostly around these two questions. Why was eugenics ideology so appealing? And what were the long-lasting results of that appeal? I'm a historian, so my sources are published documents, things like state health board reports, state welfare board reports, archival materials, letters people wrote, all these kind of historical materials. So today I'm going to give you at least some answers to both of these questions, although certainly covering them in less depth in the book. And I'll do this by looking at three phases of the development of eugenics ideology and policy. This first phase, the first couple of decades, when reformers really led by medical professionals promoted principles of eugenics in their reform networks. Second, in the 1920s, when social welfare officials embedded eugenics ideology in their policies and practices at the state level. And then more briefly, I'll touch on the 1930s and beyond as welfare programs grew and as eugenics principles remained really central to a lot of the ways that social welfare programs were running. Before I get into these exact phases, I do have one other kind of preface that I want to talk broadly about the appeal of eugenics. Eugenics was never a broad-based social movement. It's kind of inherently elitist. And so it didn't ever have a real grassroots movement behind it. But lots of people still knew about it. There were lots of popular forms of eugenics. I am notorious. Ask my students for skipping slides. Do my best. There were lots of popular forms of it, things like better baby contests at state fairs or fitter family contests. And here we have a photograph of one of those fitter families with stair-step children, white families. These are sort of dressed in athletic outfits, but often they're exhibiting, you know, middle-class status in their body language and their clothing. So it had this sort of appeal to a lot of middle-class white Americans that maybe they could have some personal control or could validate their choices. So by choosing the proper spouse, one who had, you know, good genes, good heredity, they could equip their children to have a better genetic inheritance and thus a brighter future. And then for some other people, it helped justify their privileged social positions by offering a rationale for where they stood in the social hierarchy. So that was important, that some level of widespread understanding of eugenics principles. But what I've always been interested in is how eugenics ideology appealed to the people in power, the people making decisions. At the turn of the century in North Carolina, those people were middle and upper class white people. So I want to, for a moment, paint you a picture of what North Carolina looked like at the start of this phase. It was a very different place. North Carolina in 1900 was very rural. 90% of people lived in rural areas. The per capita income in the state as a result was very low. Many of the people who were farming were tenants or sharecroppers, making, like, really falling into perpetual debt further and further. Beyond those rural areas, there was the South was modernizing, you know, textile mills were a big part of that. So small company towns were popping up. And then as industry was developing, larger cities were also growing. But if we think about Raleigh in 1900, the population of the entire city of Raleigh was 14,000 people. Only 10 to 20 years before had Raleigh gotten municipal water and sewer, streetlights, streetcars, these kind of fundamentals of modern city life. So a very different place, and also notably different because the political structures of the South had cemented a white supremacist ideology and an accompanying power structure that kept power in the hands of really a few white people. And that system was supported by one party rule by the Democratic Party and racial violence. The folks in charge, it was in their interest to perpetuate a low tax model of government that was also a low service model of government. And I highlight that because that framed all the reformers I'm talking about, all these social reformers, that framed their choices. They had realistically sort of a limited set of options for what they could do in their policies. And it meant that justifying the costs of their programs was always at the forefront of their minds. So think about all the other stuff I'm telling you about today through that filter. So for the people who were in power, eugenics appealed to many of them for sort of a range of reasons, but I think there are some patterns. Very few of them would have called themselves eugenicists. And I think that's important to note. They were drawn to arguments of people who did identify as eugenicists. And the eugenics experts of the day thought that lots of traits were heritable. They thought that traits like laziness or criminality or even temperamental qualities like constructive imagination were traits that were inherited wholesale. And thus, if you use techniques of selective reproduction, you could eradicate some of these traits. You could eradicate poverty or crime or mental illness. So that's what the eugenics experts were telling people. And following these experts, North Carolinians adopted lots of these ideas. They were most concerned with feeble-mindedness. So that's a term that doesn't really have a precise modern equivalent, but it we sort of most easily correlate it with some mental disability of some kind. But it was marked as much by social class and by sexual behavior in the ways that people defined it at the time. When people were talking about eugenics at the time, they very often mixed genetic explanations and environmental explanations with very little self-awareness. So as I'm talking through all of this, you'll hear lots of that mixing. But they generally agreed that feeble-minded parents were almost certain to have some kind of defective offspring, either because feeble-mindedness was hereditary or because these parents have the capacity to raise normal children. So I think even in this discussion of feeble-mindedness, we can begin to see how the core of the appeal to North Carolina's power brokers was partly because of the racism and classism inherent in eugenics, that aligned well with their worldview and with their kind of political imperatives to keep the status quo. But let's dig into some of the more specific reasons. So I'm going to highlight several reasons in this first phase that I think eugenics appealed to folks. And the first is a desire to advance science. As much as they were getting the science wrong, they wanted to advance science. And so we can look at medical doctors here. In this first phase, I mentioned physicians were really important supporters, explorers of eugenics. Their medical training predisposed them to look for scientific rationales to the social problems they saw around them in their patients. And they debated the principles and the applications of eugenics at most of their medical society meetings. So most were convinced that heredity played a large role in determining traits like insanity, alcoholism, criminality, but again, with their views kind of leaning towards Lamarckian sorts of ideas. So they thought about things, heredity, for example, as habit fixed by past environment, or thought that degeneration might be a result of excess in the ancestor. This is an excerpt from a speech that Charles Lackinghouse, who was a renowned physician and the state health officer for much of the early 20th century, that he gave at the dedication of an opening of an institution for feeble-minded children, which I'll tell you a little bit more about in a minute. But he said at this speech that these problems were increasing so much that normal human beings will become extinct. There was a pretty widespread understanding that feeble-minded people or other defective people reproduced at higher rates than quote normal people. So there was a sense of fear. You know, later folks talked about it as race suicide. So a sense of normal people going extinct. Nothing but segregation or constant surveillance, he said, will protect them and protect society against their power to spoil future generations with hereditary taint. And he talked about segregation as evolution's plan, so sort of linking this to their scientific understanding by which we can get rid of its the feeble-minded population and eliminate social waste. I also want to tell you a little more about this institution that he was speaking at. And a key player here is Ira Hardy, who was a physician who attended both UNC and NC State, so neither of us can really claim credit here. And he was key in lobbying the state to establish this custodial institution for feeble-minded children, which was, I think, chartered in 1911 and opened in 1914. And his motivation was at least partly personal. He had a daughter who had some sort of historically unspecified mental disabilities who actually died a couple of years after the institution opened. And as you can see in the title of his speech, this is a speech from when he was pitching the idea of what it costs. He's referring back to the sort of social and financial costs of having what they saw as this really uncontrolled problem of feeble-minded people. So he thought the institution, although the state would have to pay for it, it would ultimately save the state money because they would prevent crime and delinquency that people assumed were associated with feeble-mindedness. But another part of Hardy's motivation was advancing knowledge. So he corresponded and worked with Charles Davenport, who was one of the leaders at the Eugenics Record Office in Cold Spring Harbor, and one of the precursors there to a lot of the genetics research that still happens. So he worked with the ERO and Charles Davenport to fund the training of a eugenics field worker. And so this was a program that the ERO did for many years. They had cohorts of people come, mostly women, and train them to go out and do family studies and do pedigree charts and this sort of thing. So North Carolina sent a field worker named Sybil Hyatt, who had been a school teacher for many years, who'd become interested in psychology and had taken some summer courses at Columbia University, including one in the title was Comparative and Genetic Psychology. So this had been sort of a latent interest for her. And then she went and in 1912 did the field worker training at the ERO. She then returned to North Carolina and completed a study, which as far as I can find is the first kind of systematic eugenic study in the Southeast about cacogenic families, right? So cacogenic meaning negative, you know, bad genes, dysgenic. And you can see some of her newspaper coverage here in the final report, which underscored the need for Caswell, the school I mentioned, to be built to, quote, eliminate feeble-mindedness from the race. And in his reports then, Ira Hardy was making the case that this was a great contribution to Southern research about eugenics. A second reason that eugenics appealed to folks was it made a lot of sense with the state's agricultural knowledge. Worked well in a rural state. So here's a quote from Harry Woodburn Chase, who was a psychologist at UNC, basically talking about bad seed. He said, institutionalizing mental defectives is on par with throwing away some of the bad ears of corn that come from poor seed, but saving the remainder to use for seed for next season. We also have a quote here from Lewis McBrayer, another leading physician. He ran the state's tuberculosis sanitarium, and he was one of the trustees for many years for the Caswell School. And he was also president of the medical society, let me see. He said, men who are interested in the creation of better livestock are familiar with the Mendelian law of heredity. Our state has awakened to the meaning of this law so far as the lower animals are concerned. In fact, everything about the place is thoroughbred and pedigreed except God's children. So making this argument, we know the science, let's apply it to humans. Using these kind of agricultural metaphors that farmers absolutely would have been familiar with. Another reason, I'm gonna draw on McBrayer again here in a minute, is that co-eugenics reformers made arguments about the utility of eugenics in terms of religious arguments. And I'll give you an example here. There's another side of this I'm not talking about today that has to do with charity, and people really saw eugenics as a form of charity, but we're leaving that aside for today. So McBrayer, again, talks about humans as being God's leaders, humans enacting God's work. And this is, I think, maybe my favorite quote I found in all, you know, however many years I've worked on this project. The good book says that God created men in his own image out of the dust of the earth. But he's not populating the earth in that way now. He's not doing that stunt anymore. He has turned that job over to us. We are then working together with God in the creation of those who are to follow us. We generate the race. We alone can regenerate. So, you know, the religion of the reformers differed and was varied somewhat by class, but many people in the state were devout and practicing Christians. And so these sorts of analogies helped them bring this new and somewhat unfamiliar science in line with their existing beliefs. And the last reason in this phase, I think, that eugenics appealed really comes down to race. Eugenics was always about race everywhere it happened. And that means that in different places, you see different forms. So in the Northeast, where the primary racial concern was immigration, that's the form policies took. Immigration wasn't really a concern in the South, but people in power were concerned about maintaining the existing racial power structure. This is partly because the boundaries were so, they required constant maintenance, right? White and Black people had children together in many different forms for many different years, but the power of white supremacy rested on actually having strict racial divisions and on white people policing those boundaries. So the reformers who created North Carolina's eugenics policy were using the supposed scientific authority of eugenics to prop up this white supremacist ideology that they have. And they were particularly worried about poor white people, because to them, poor white people were alarming evidence that maybe white people weren't superior, right? That white people could be degenerate. They challenged the very logic of white supremacy. So in North Carolina, as in some other Southern states, the initial push in eugenics programs was actually to improve the genetic inheritance of white people. In later years, the program would turn to targeting Black people for sterilization, but in its first several decades, they actually focused on white people. So William Louis Poteet, made him Louise because that's my middle name. Type that automatically. He was the president of Wake Forest College. He was a biologist. He was interested in Mendelian genetics, and he was an important public intellectual in the state. He was one of the primary people who was talking about evolution and defending evolution pretty early on. And he had this idea that there was a North Carolina type that was the product of kind of the unique mixture of white immigrants we had in the state and their interaction with the environment. And he defined this North Carolina type as sterling, self-reliant, frank, and conservatively progressive. Other folks talked about an Anglo-Saxon type, referring to a similar kind of thing. And so these reformers were really trying to push for eugenics programs to improve the genetic inheritance of this group of white people, this Anglo-Saxon group, by sort of calling out the unfits or the deviants so that the remaining Anglo-Saxon group was racially pure. So during, just to cap off this bit and then hopefully move quickly to the rest, during this period, a coalition of reformers and policymakers came together who supported these ideas and sought a whole package of eugenics reforms, including the school that Hardy built, marriage restrictions, and sterilization laws. Some even went as far as calling for euthanasia for people with mental disabilities. I'm not going to tell you about all the various legislation that came about, but I do want to talk about how eugenics ideology became embedded in welfare programs, because this is one of the questions that initially drove my interest in the project. Is how did these two programs become tied together? So even before the New Deal North Carolina was one of the national leaders in figuring out what welfare looked like in a rural area. And they were responding to conditions like this. This is a photograph from the 1880s of the Durham court home and jail. They were combined. And so they passed laws that created a sort of a statewide system with a welfare superintendent in each county. And here you can see their progress on that in 1926. All these new social workers had to be trained. Most had no prior social work experience. So the State Welfare Board, working with the School of Public Welfare at UNC, trained all these people. And the state's Commissioner of Public Welfare, Kate Burr Johnson, and many of her staff were very interested in eugenics. And that showed up in the ways that they trained social workers to think about the problems they saw. So here we have Kate Burr Johnson talking about the problem of feeble-mindedness, mental deficiency, as really at the root of most social problems that she saw. So she and her staff thought if we could pull out feeble-mindedness, we could solve these social problems. They used photographs to indicate how mental defects could doom a family to poverty. And so this is from a 1921 bulletin. They sent out thousands of copies of this where they posed these two pictures next to each other in the bulletin. And their point was about mother's aid, which was sort of a precursor to aid to families with dependent children. But I think you can see in how they frame this, what they think a fit family looks like and what an unfit family looks like. So here, even though this is a single, probably widowed mother, we have all white children dressed in white, sort of a clean photograph. And here we have a family where the lighting is difficult, but it does seem like there is probably, the reader is probably supposed to see this as evidence of racial mixing. And so even the racial mixing as a behavior being something that made a family unfit. And so they're making a point that they're mentally defective and they're costly to the state and they are responsible for vice and crime in the community. Another photograph showing how they linked unfitness and racial mixing. In this image, this is the point they're trying to make is that county homes, like that Durham one I saw you, are breeding places for the feeble-minded. And the evidence they present for that is this woman, this is how they describe her, that her child's features suggest a Black father. And so that's the evidence, right? Like racial mixing is evidence of her being feeble-minded. They also argued that white children needed to be preserved, drawing on some of these agricultural metaphors from earlier. The white children are North Carolina's best crop. The state during this period funded research and mental programs, which they then used for publicity and to train their workers. So they hired Harry Crane, who had a PhD in psychology from Michigan and had experience as a eugenics field worker. And he headed this division whose mandate was testing, research, and education. And a key part of work was testing lots of people, often individually, but also in group settings. And in the process of testing, they created this enormous registry on color-coded index cards that were cross-referenced. About 30,000 entries in the first decade. They also conducted family studies. Oh, that went sideways, I'm sorry. Families that they thought were filled with cacogenic strains. And here's the one that they made the most of over the years. This was a study of a family called the Wake family. They argued that the family members were immoral, were drug addicts, were filthy, and that they had cost the state $20,000, which they said was the same as the board's annual appropriation. Again, making this argument, if we'd spent money on prevention through sterilizing or institutionalizing people, we wouldn't have to spend money on the effects of this feeble-mindedness. They made an exhibit with this that actually included photographs of the family, and that exhibit went to the state fair. It went to other states as far as Chicago, Minnesota, Florida. They got a lot of mileage out of this. So during this critical period, in the 20s, the state built a welfare infrastructure that provided some stronger support for people they thought were deserving, like widowed mothers, white mothers, and children and the elderly, but at the same time, created more state supervision of people they saw as unfit. So poor Black people, delinquent youth, and what they called mental defectives. In this third phase, and I'll wrap up very shortly here, the state finally passed what they called a workable sterilization law in 1929. And then they set up a case that is super interesting, but I won't tell you about it today, that was essentially a test case to rewrite the law and make the 1933 law, which was had some due process protections to make it a little more legally sound. And that law set up the eugenics board, which was housed in the welfare offices. So when the New Deal arrived, local welfare departments grew in size and number, but it was the same state welfare officials with all their beliefs about eugenic fitness who continued to train the hundreds of new local welfare administrators. And training in eugenics ideology was still a standard part of their instruction. At the same time, budgetary constraints during the Great Depression created an additional incentive to sterilize recipients of welfare benefits. A state commission called for expanding sterilization, and Division of Mental Health and Hygiene continued offering testing. So even as the state was trying to provide some relief to the worthy or the fit, state officials promoted what they called eugenical social work for the socially useless. So we can see that this happened, all this increase with the program growing over the next two decades. And this is sterilizations by race and marital status. So we can see, none of my charts unfortunately show this super clearly. There's a trend after about 1957 where a majority of the sterilizations were of Black people and primarily Black women. So the 50s and 60s were the peak of the programs if you add up all these numbers. And the thing that's consistent over time is that most of the people sterilized were women. So I think particularly in this final period, we can see how reformers first and then welfare officials helped define citizenship for the state as having partly to do with people's inherited capabilities. So now we see citizenship as sort of a package of rights and responsibilities that you get either through birth or naturalization. But in the early 20th century, that package was not solidified. It was kind of ill-defined. And during these critical periods in the 1920s and 30s, as federal and state governments were figuring out what a social safety net looked like, policymakers had to decide who was going to benefit from this social safety net. And in many of their decisions about welfare programs, North Carolina's officials relied on eugenics ideology to help make those decisions. So instead of assuming that welfare provisions were some kind of right, they divided the fit from the unfit and created a model of welfare where only the fit sort of got the benefits and the unfit instead had more supervision. I don't have great lessons from all of this. I'm actually more interested in what you all have, what you think about the lessons. I'll just point out two quick things. Think about all those cards that the Division of Mental Health and Hygiene created. That data was collected for research purposes, but it was later used as a tool in targeting people for sterilization. And I think beyond the sort of individual level concerns that things like IRB protocols are meant to protect against, I think we need to think carefully about the data that we produce en masse, as we're in this era of big data and generative AI and, you know, precision medicine, all these legitimate uses of data. But think about how that data has potential for misuse, even if we're like not leaking it on servers that get hacked or something. It's the existence of this data. I think we have to treat that data carefully. And then the broader lesson I'll present is thinking about the role of science in leading to policy. And I think a thing that's drawn me to this project for 20 years now is this question of how do we get from ideology to policy, right? It takes people to write the policy, to implement the policy. And the people have preconceived notions. So I think we can see how by the 1930s, even though science had really kind of turned away from some of these more simplistic descriptions of how inheritance worked by that point, the policy was already set, right? Because the people who had absorbed that we can call it science communication now, at an earlier stage, had come to it with their own assumptions and then had built policy around kind of a combination of assumption and science. So in a way, it never was about the science. Eugenics was always attractive because it served other ideological, political, social purposes. And so I think that's just sort of a broader cautionary tale that we'd all do well to think about. But I'd love to hear your thoughts, and I'll turn to questions.
Okay, so we'll get started with questions in a minute. If you're online, we really encourage you to participate. So use the raise your hand function if you would like to ask your question, or put it in the chat and I'll read it for you.
Hey. Thank you. Thank you for your talk. For context, my dad's a retired psychiatrist from UNC School of Medicine and both researcher and clinician, and wrote a lot about the closing of institutions in North Carolina. And so there's a flip side to think about that I want to unpack a little bit if we have a moment. I mean, the closing of institutions also, with other variables, of course, gave rise to the unhoused population that we see today and a lot of other complexities in society that we don't have great solutions for. And so in that context, and with a historian's mind, which I think would be really useful here, is there a way to disentangle eugenics from this idea of institutionalization, acknowledging the role of consent and sort of how that's evolved? But you can, you know, how that can, I don't know, those are just some tensions I see in this field. And I didn't know if you had any thoughts on that, the two sides of that coin.
Yes, I'm not sure you can disentangle them is the short answer, at least in their histories. There's some really great books about the histories of institutions, you know, across the country, and many of them were founded for similar kinds of reasons, or at least had a period of their history when part of their articulated function was serving as an institution to segregate this population from the rest of the population. That said, there were a lot of families before Caswell was founded who were in some way unable to care for children who had mental disabilities. And the institution served that important function. You know, I'm not sure they were, in fact, I know they weren't treated very well at the institution. So yes, I mean, like, this is such a, it's a challenging question because I think our understanding of, you know, patient rights and stuff was very different in the early 20th century. So although there was rhetoric that these institutions were needed to care for children, often in the very same sentence, there would be a flip and say, and also you don't want these children sitting next to yours in a classroom. So, I don't think people necessarily saw that as a tension at the time, right? It was care and protect. Mm-hmm. All the time, and I think, you know, there are certainly ways to do institutions better than that, and I think, yeah, what we've seen since deinstitutionalization last, what, four decades now, I think shows the need for some institutions. But I think, yeah, historians are always, Our answer was kind of like, it's complicated, and let's think carefully about this.
Yeah,
so that's
my answer. That's often my answer.
Yeah. Yeah. And what's your name?
Yeah, Will Kimmerer. So I'm a historian. You have some in the room and online as well.
Yeah.
Going back to your first slide and then your last, you know, for some lessons to pull.
Yeah.
And one of the other ones, stepping away from just eugenics, you know, as just one example, but I think it shows that policymakers, especially looking for low cost, efficiency, productivity, you know, whether it's national wealth or whether it's efficiency of the state providing services, I mean, they're going to look to science to provide quick tools, quick answers, and it's easy to sell the simple answers, the quick answers, even if it's bad science, poor science, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go back even the earliest animal breeding textbooks, like the one used here at NC State in the 1880s, you know, it starts with, you know, the farmer to make more money should be following these rules of breeding we've discovered. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the Mendelian Revolution picked up on that animal breeding side, as you pointed out. But, you know, that appeal of science will provide this quick and dirty tool seems to be another kind of broad lesson you could always draw it was, it's sitting out there as something to take.
Yeah.
And especially if you've got a promoter like Davenport, who is able to pull all the resources of the impression, you know, the image of science into promises.
Yeah. That's a great point. And I think it, that kind of promise of an easy solution, it was particularly effective in the time period I'm talking about here, you know, 1900 to 1920. It was the progressive era. People were convinced that if they put enough experts on a problem, they could solve things and they could solve it efficiently. And so I think a lot of the language of eugenics of sort of diagnosis and prevention, that played very smoothly into the mindset of these reformers who truly thought that experts, like they said, okay, you know, the fact that we haven't eliminated feeble-mindedness yet, it just means we need bigger institutions, or it means we need sterilization instead of institutionalization, or we need more marriage restrictions. They didn't see the fault in their logic. They said, no, keep doing the same. We just haven't done enough.
So there's a title suggestion in your book, which is Efficient Reform. Had to put it in some ironic quotes so you can keep the spread, but anyway, there is a kind of a nice line that you're all forgotten. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I was going to say, maybe we can read Carolyn Veal's question and then also get to Jeff Thorne afterwards.
Can I interject? Are you guys able to hear me?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I actually am teaching my class now. It's called Race, Membership, and Eugenics. And actually, I have about 20 plus students who have been Zooming in with you. And this question actually comes from one of my students, Asha Coltrane. So I just wanted to clear that up. And again, thank you, Dr. Crones-Luckins, for being here.
Thank you. And thank you, Asha. West Virginia. So Buckley Bell was the case that the U.S. Supreme Court decided in 1927 that upheld Virginia's sterilization law. And Oliver Wendell Holmes' decision in that case sort of infamously said three generations of imbeciles is enough. North Carolina revised its law, it was actually a 1919 law and then a 1929 law that they revised to be a little more in line with what Buckley Bell had done, and then that 33 revision. I believe pieces of North Carolina's law have been overturned, but I think there are still elements there. And that's a question I really should know the answer to. And so I'll make sure I know the answer to it after this talk. The eugenics board itself, the policy or policy body that made these decisions was disbanded in the late 1970s. It was functional until then. But I have that, you know, there were most states had a sterilization law. So I'm positive there are still laws out there that still stand. I mean, as you mentioned, West Virginia had its last law overturned only in 2012. So I wouldn't be surprised if there are still laws out there. I'm sorry, I can't answer that more specifically for you about North Carolina. I truly should have answered. But thank you, Carolyn.
Yeah, and if we could get Jeff Thorne, if you could unmute yourself and ask your question.
Sure. I guess the first thing I want to say is I like that you distinguished policy of eugenics from ideology, but I think also the policies that, you know, are clearly horrible that were put in place because of eugenics aren't necessarily what the academics who in the 20s or 30s would have called themselves eugenicists would advocate. And you pointed this out, but I think that now the meaning of eugenics to us is different than the meaning of eugenics, especially to people and to academics before World War II. So for example, if we're doing gene editing of a human disease gene, I think that might be perceived by a lot of people now as being a good thing. And it would have been perceived as one of the goals of eugenics by some of the eugenicists. Now, some of the eugenicists in the early part of the century just had nasty ideas, right? Terrible ideas. But some of them, they I think were motivated by the kinds of things that we still think are good to care about when we're studying human genetics. And so I just wanted to make that point that I think that sometimes we view, people view incorrectly the eugenics ideas before World War II as this monolith where everybody had a homogenous set of beliefs. And I expect that a lot of the eugenicists at the time wouldn't have supported the policies that were put in place in the South. So thanks.
Yeah, so I think one of the ways that I've tried to approach this project is thinking about trying to take down that monolith of eugenics ideology, to try to say ideology is this nebulous thing out here, right? And it's an ideology because many people share elements of it, but each person is thinking about those principles of eugenics or that ideology of eugenics through their own lived experience, through their own, whatever knowledge they have. And that's where thinking about these kind of mid-level practitioners of eugenics, the state and local welfare officials, these people that we wouldn't call eugenicists. They're not Charles Davenport, they're not these big names that we know about on a national level, but they're actually critical in making eugenics ideology become a reality. And in perpetuating the ideology too, building it into policy and giving that ideology new life as part of that. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. I just wanted to ask you to address this issue of, what's the scope of eugenics? Because you think about the whole issue of improving something genetically. We now have a lot more ideas about what that means, but the tension still is between what's the role of the genes versus the environment. And say in the past that there was this excessive reliance on genetics. But even today, I think we're seeing a trend of people saying that there's a lot more we can do with genetics than perhaps we really can. And that's sort of this sort of revision of what does eugenics mean. It does seem like there's a lot of momentum. Thank you. Eugenics.
So I tend to think of eugenics as efforts to improve the human race and improve the human race's genetic inheritance. But I think that can be through either genetic interventions or environmental interventions, the way that people, because I think the same people share the belief that you can improve the human race, or I think people who believe you can improve the human race think you can often do it either through things like gene editing or environmental ways. So I tend to treat it as sort of an expansive definition of eugenics, but at the same time, I'm pretty reluctant to label individual people eugenicists, if that makes sense, because I don't see often eugenics as being the single defining feature of their ideology. And so even the folks I write about, I don't call really any of them eugenicists. I talk about how they think about these ideas, how they put these ideas into practice. Am I answering your question? I feel like I'm not quite.
Not because you sort of said that eugenics includes both the environment and the genes. So then there's no tension.
I mean, I think there is tension between people who think that one is more important than the other. And I think that tension is there historically. And we certainly have better understanding of the whole field of epigenetics now than we did in 1910. But I think people who sort of have the hubris to think that they can improve the entire gene pool of the human race also tend to not be careful about their science and about which pieces of things they're going to use. I'm not a scientist, so I'm please excuse my, you know, my lack of understanding if I'm trampling on the science, but that's what I see in historical time period I study. And I think that's how I would try to sort of carry it forward. And then you, yes.
Yeah, I was, you mentioned, remember correctly about like compensation over ratios of family affected by this. And, you know, I think now people are, want to address these things, you know, whether that's like groups that have been affected with the races or, you know, like colonial or whatever, maybe. I'm just curious about how this was done, lessons that can be learned from it, like reparations or compensations. But like, if you can talk more about that.
Yeah. So North Carolina's compensation was a long time coming and took a bipartisan effort that I think in that bipartisan effort, it actually took skimming over some aspects of the program in order to find political consensus. So the two folks who were most important in creating the, so Bev Perdue, when she was governor, created a commission to look at this. And then Representative Womble from Greensboro and Senator Tillis, coming from two different parties, one white, one black, came together to put together the reparations program. And Senator Tillis is Catholic and talked about how the sort of Catholic value of life was important for him in supporting this. And Representative Womble talked about it from sort of a civil rights perspective. So it took that bipartisan consensus and like picking out those elements of the history to highlight. I think the thing that got left behind was any conversation about reproductive autonomy and the fact that this happened mostly to women and even really discussions of kind of class as removed from race. So I'm glad we have the compensation program. I also wish that discussion had included, to me, sort of a fuller discussion of the history. And there have been, I think Virginia, I believe, also passed some kind of program. Georgia has discussed it. There have been discussions in places where it has gone places. It is kind of a similar, let's pull out the pieces of the story that we can find political consensus around. So I don't know if that has lessons for other kind of reparations efforts, maybe.
Thank you for a really interesting talk. It sounds like feeble-mindedness was essentially used as a clinical diagnosis at the time. I'm just curious if there were ever any, if there was ever any sort of clearly articulated set of criteria for what made someone feeble-minded, or was it more of a subjective designation based on perceived things like social economic status or race or something like that?
Yeah. So the closest that we get to an objective designation is divisions of IQs. Idiocy, imbecility, high grade feeble mindedness. And so one of the things that Harry Crane and the Division of Mental Hygiene urged was that social workers bring their clients, their patients to get tested so they could be assigned a label based on IQ. That very often wasn't possible, or social workers just didn't do it. And so they used that term of feeble-mindedness like pretty rampantly based on subjective things about class status, how heavy their homes were. And often they were coming to that conclusion based on their observations, their subjective observations, and then going to the Division of Mental Health and Hygiene to have that diagnosis confirmed, essentially, with all that we could say about problems with IQ tests, even now to a far greater extent in the early 20th century, when you're dealing with a population that's, you know, educated at something like a fifth grade level.
Thank you.
Right.
Yeah, I was just wondering if, you know, we always see those charts of how many people are sterilized. And I'm wondering a little bit about whether that's surprisingly high or way surprisingly low, in the sense of, you know, in the history, did you see a lot of contestation of those things? Like, did people go to court to fight them? Or, you know, like, how did that equilibrium of how many were being sterilized get a stamp?
Yeah. So in the 1930s, the state was sterilizing about 175 people a year. I don't know whether they call that low or high, right?
I'm wondering if something tapped it down. Now, was there?
Not until the 1960s. So the 1950s and 60s were the peak of it. And so I really should have just showed you overall numbers, but it rises over time into the 50s and 60s, and then is pretty steady. And then as the combination of the civil rights movement, sort of more attention to reproductive rights grows, their massive pushback did emerge, and it fell off very rapidly at that point. There was low level pushback all along.
That's what I was
wondering. And Johanna Schern has written a great book called Choice and Coercion that addresses these later years. And she talks about how all of these were contested situations. Often what happened if a family pushed back or if an individual pushed back, the social worker would drop the case for a while and maybe pick it up later. There are stories of, you know, when welfare officials wanted to sterilize the whole family, the family would move in the middle of the night and go to the next county, where maybe that superintendent of public welfare wasn't as interested in pushing the case forward. I mean, that's an immense cost for the family, right, to do that.
Yeah.
The 1933 version of the law was supposed to create due process protections, but, you know, that it was far more coercive than true due process protections would indicate, including things like the state could appoint a guardian for the person who would consent on their behalf.
You know, I want to point out, though, that, I mean, so the laws are always daunting for appeals, but there was this appeal process, but very few families did it. Now you could argue that's access to justice.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of things. But also, I mean, the counterbalance is lots of the families could request the sterilization.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of cases of families, as you were saying, unable to deal with their whatever in their family.
Yeah.
Right. And so that kind of balances out. But then there's also a strange record of a lot of the sterilizations in North Carolina were not done through the board, but done through individual doctors, which is your ideology.
Yes, and I think that's another place the state needs to address, because so far the state has refused compensation requests from individuals who were sterilized outside of that state structures. And it's clear to me that the state still bears at least a moral ability for those. But on the point of requesting, too, not just families requesting, but individual women sometimes would actually seek out a sterilization because of their limited contraceptive options. So a permanent sterilization for a woman who'd had multiple pregnancies every 2 years for 20 years, a permanent sterilization actually seemed like a good deal. And if all she had to admit was being feeble-minded to a social worker, then that was a deal some women were really willing to make. And Johanna writes about that.
We're out of time, aren't we?
No, it's okay. You can finish your sentence. I find that actually really interesting because it's actually very hard to get a sterilization now if you want one. Because who knows what you might want later. Anyway, thank you for coming. And thank you for joining online and asking good questions and having a good discussion. If you RSVP for lunch, we obviously have it. Sorry for the disruption a few minutes ago getting that into the room. Next week, we have Zoom, Steve Hine from Canva. It's going to be very interesting. So join in for that, but it's Zoom only, so stay in your offices until I'm over here. Okay. Thank you.